Well, today's third lecture, you might think, was deliberately designed to be the follow-on to the first two lectures, but actually that's not true. As you remember, we've kind of chopped up the way in which this course went. So we took, you know, one from one category, one from the other category. So it's just a happy coincidence that all three of today's lectures are on the subject of collective action and different aspects of the theory of collective action. And I think that's a very, very nice combination. So the question today, this is coming out of the discussion of Chinese history, which I have done and some other people have done, with the idea that philosophy of social science is actually very relevant to discussions and testing of hypotheses about Chinese history. And so what I have done in the book that you have a copy of, Understanding Peasant China, is to look at some theoretical hypotheses which have been used in Chinese historical writing, or writing about Chinese history, and then to ask, you know, how good are these theories, what is the empirical status of these theories, and how do they relate to each other? One of the big, big questions is the question, how do we explain the occurrence of a whole series of large peasant rebellions in China, mostly in the 19th century, in other words, mostly in the middle to late Qing Empire? Why did these large peasant rebellions, and peasant rebellions are, of course, rural rebellions, you don't find a lot of peasants in major cities. So why did these large rural rebellions take place? And it's an interesting question, both because it's a question about the explanation of the behavior of hundreds of thousands, in some cases millions of people. So it's an explanation of coordinated and uncoordinated activities by huge numbers of people. And secondly, the rebellions themselves were historically very important. They challenged the Qing emperor. They had the possibility of actually bringing down the Chinese empire, bringing down the state. The Taiping Rebellion, for example, in the 1860s, involved tens of millions of people and did have the capacity for overthrowing the Chinese state, though in the end it was repressed. So these were rebellions that were very, very important. They're also very interesting rebellions. Interesting because when scholars do the historical research, they find that there are very different elements in each of these rebellions which point to different kinds of collective action. And so some of these historians have kind of said, these are really different perspectives on Chinese behavior. Others, including myself, say, no, they're not different perspectives, they're different aspects of Chinese behavior and Chinese mobilization. In other words, they are true theories of a complicated world of social mobilization. So the question then is, and I'm posing here a couple of different kinds of questions. One question is, were there large historical factors which caused the outbreak of rebellion? What kind of factors might those be? And I'll talk about that in a minute. But the more specific question is, what were the origins of peasant behavior, peasant motivation, peasant mobilization? What were the factors which led peasants to involve themselves in the risky business of rebellion? And then fourth question, which is highly pertinent to the discussions we've been having now for the last several lectures, how do the theories of collective action, class politics, the role of religion and identity, how do these theories contribute to satisfactory explanation of these large-scale peasant mobilizations? But let's talk just for another second before I change slides about the large historical factors. Historians sometimes want to attribute rebellion to really large factors, including environmental factors. So drought, for example, or crop failure over a big extended area, a situation of famine, a situation of large-scale material hardship, too much rain, too little rain, crop failures. these would be large factors which some historians have said it's these kind of factors that you should refer to when you want to explain the occurrence of rebellion. And there's one sense in which it's obvious that crop failure and famine has the possibility of creating large social reaction simply because people are under huge stress. They have to find a solution. And their solution may be eating banana leaves, or it may be attacking the local granary, which still has food, or it may be just going out on the road and begging and stealing and whatever, kind of an individual strategy. But famine produces individuals finding some solution. People don't generally just sit at home and wait to die. They try to find some way of solving this terrible material problem. And in China in particular, the fact of large environmental catastrophe is an important piece of Chinese history. The control of water, flooding, the massive government structures, both local and centrally controlled, which were used to control the Yellow River and I think maybe the Yangtze River as well. These large environmental factors of water control and agriculture, those factors are very important to Chinese history. So large factors certainly are relevant and pertinent. A different kind of large factor would be the role and activity and behavior of the state, where some people have said that it is the state that causes rebellion through its own actions, maybe by bad use of the military, maybe by disregarding the needs of the people in terms of famine. So some people have said state behavior is a large factor that causes, or is at least one of the contributing causes to large rebellions. These are topics, these large kind of historical factors, these are topics I find interesting, but for today I'm just going to focus on the issue of peasant motivation and peasant mobilization. What is it that leads the peasant to support these large but dangerous activities? So I'm not trying to offer a comprehensive theory of revolution or rebellion. There are historical sociologists who offer such theories, and they're very interesting theories. Instead, we will ask the more focused question, what is it that motivates people to become rebels? What explains rural collective action from the point of view of the peasants who participate in those collective actions? What other local factors are necessary or conducive to either encouraging or discouraging collective action and uprising? In other words, can we identify local factors, maybe environmental, maybe organizational, maybe village politics, maybe the presence of religious organizations? Can we identify various factors which make mobilization and collective action more likely? And I'm going to actually look at three different theories, what I call a local politics theory, which is kind of a rational choice theory, a class conflict theory, which is a Marxist theory, and then what I call a millenarian theory, which is really a religious ideology theory. And the reason why I identify these theories is that some historians have said there are three different kinds of rebellions that occurred. There are rebellions that occurred because of local politics, there are rebellions that occurred because of class conflict, and there are rebellions that occurred because of religious, basically Buddhist, ideas. I think that's the wrong way of characterizing. I don't think there are three different kinds of rebellions. Instead, there are several different ways in which people come to have motivations to be involved, and some of those rebellions had more of the one or more of the other, but I wouldn't want to really separate too sharply among the kinds. For example, I think that both local politics and class have involvement in all of the rebellions that we can talk about, but they are involved in different ways and through different mechanisms. So the local politics theory of rebellion looks at rebellion from the point of view of the motives of individual rebels and leaders. It asks the question, what factors lead peasants to decide to support a budding rebellion and to determine the level of support? And support means different things. It means maybe there's been a call for a mass demonstration on the French. and this would be a Vietnamese example, that the French are being really bad and the peasants should come together and protest. Well, if a call for protest goes out, the peasant individual or family has to decide, will I do that or not do that? And the question we're asking is what makes the individual make the choice that he or she does? These local politics theories are based essentially on that kind of loose theory of individual rationality or individual agency that I explored last time, and looks also at the local environment of choice or the institutional arrangements at the local level which create the environment in which individuals choose. It establishes the opportunities and the risks associated. So using this theory, we need to ask, what are the individual's needs, what are the individual's interests and motives, what are the sources of potential solidarity at the level of the individual, and what are the concrete goals of the participants? Here we can talk about political entrepreneurship. We can talk about the question, what is it that motivates the leader or the group of leaders who are moving towards rebellion or towards collective interest, collective action? What are their private interests? How are they able to use popular organizations and popular motivation to pursue their own political ends? I find a particularly useful example of political entrepreneurship in the form of ethnic conflict in India, where Indian nationalism, Hindu nationalism, at various times has broken out into anti-Muslim violence and pogrom or murder and mayhem against Muslim communities. And the question, why does that occur? I find the most persuasive common explanation that parties have an interest in pushing forward their agenda, and one of the instruments they use is whipping up Hindu nationalist sentiment. In other words, political entrepreneurship and party leading to concerted effort to build up Hindu nationalism and hatred of Muslims. Coming back to China, we can also analyze, and local politics theories are very interested in analyzing, how local organizations function as instruments of collective mobilization and action. And organizations as widely different as crop watching societies, where a group of farmers agree that they will always have a child out there scaring away the birds and also the people who want to steal the corn. It may take more than a child to scare away the thieves, but the birds they can get rid of. But that takes organization, because it requires that all the households agree to participate and to provide some labor. Bandit gangs are a different end of the spectrum, and it is an important piece of the theory that we're looking at here, that bandit gangs were endemic, that they were common in rural Chinese society, that young, unattached men often had very few opportunities in the village, and so they were easily recruited into bandit gangs doing things like salt smuggling, highway robbery, etc., kind of basic criminal activity. And a bandit gang is itself a form of organization. It offers benefits to those who join the bandit gang. It also has sources of income through its illegal activities, and it has leadership. A village militia would be another kind of organized or local organization. A village militia may be a response to the very same process of bandit gang formation. If in a region with hundreds of small villages, if bandits become a more significant problem, then it is also a very rational response on the part of the village to have some organized defense. And so militias, local, just 10 or 20 men from the village who are armed lightly, who have a little bit of training, and then who defend the village against the bandits, that would be called a village militia. So the person the first revolutionary rebellion that I'm interested in talking about is the Nian Rebellion in the 1840s and 50s in North China. I think it's Shandong. I think that's correct. but it's, in any case, it's in North China. And her analysis, there were a number of middle-sized rebellions in the 1840s, 50s, and 60s. The Red Spears Rebellion is another one. There are a bunch of these rebellions. Her basic theory is that these rebellions were not deliberate, intentional rebellions by anyone. It's a surprising theory. Big rebellions occurred. They were very challenging to the state. In the end, tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of rebels came together in rebel armies. And yet, according to Elizabeth Perry, it was the result of unintentional interactions between two different strategies. So in other words, not a deliberate revolutionary or rebellious movement, but instead an escalation of violence, which led finally to overt rebellion, but was not aimed at rebellion. What she describes is an interlocking set of strategies between villages and predators, predators being bandit gangs, in which villages and predators each push up the level of violence. The bandit gangs get larger, they get better armed. The villages, in turn, push their militias to a higher level of military capability. Maybe a bunch of villages come together and form a multi-village militia. The bandit gangs, in order to continue their predatory behavior, become even larger, do more recruiting, till ultimately you have, let's say, 5,000 bandits led by a charismatic bandit leader living in the countryside, presumably not in the market town. Why does the bandit not live in the market town? It's because the market town is very accessible to the army, and so bandits are very clever types. They live where the army does not go frequently, and so they are out in the boondocks. They are out in the hills or the marshes. But they're large, and they are a threatening force. And so this dialectic, or this this interaction of strategies between the predators, the bandits, and the defensive strategy, the militias, gets higher and higher. Now, why did the contest begin in the first place? This is where Elizabeth Perry refers to the large factor of environmental distress. She refers to a whole series, a really kind of tragic series of flooding, and then drought, and then more flooding, and then more drought, a series of about 75 years in which agriculture in North China was just substantially disrupted. So there were recurring crises of agricultural failure, famine, malnutrition, hard times all over the place in North China. And it's her view that that's the crisis which originally got the predatory strategy going as a beginning. The bandit gangs were kind of expelled from villages. It just became more and more of a predatory organization. So ecological stress on local rural society in Shandong, I was right about that, and then a cycle of predation and defense leading to an escalation of rural violence. It's important to her, though, that the bandit gangs were not intending to become rebellious armies. They were intending to do their business of highway robbery, salt smuggling, etc. And the village militias also were not intending to become defenders of the social order. They were rather intending to protect their village. So nobody intended large-scale conflict between rebel armies and the state. Instead, each is jockeying for position and becoming more and more powerful. So this is an emphasis on unintended consequences, an escalation between two parties, each pushing the level of violence higher. Let's see if I got everything there. The protective strategies that she refers to, the crop-watching societies, but local militia, the building and fortification, but also tax resistance, which would be also a protective strategy. When you might say there are two different kinds of predators in local society. There are the bandits, but there are also the tax authorities who are interested in collecting crops at a time when the crops are in short supply, when the food is in short supply. And so village militias would also then become involved in tax resistance as well as resistance against bandits. Here's where the state comes in. At a certain level of rural violence, the state, the Qing state, has to be concerned about the emergence of these large armed forces in the countryside. And so at some point, the county magistrate and then higher up in the imperial authorities, the fact of large bandit armies in Shandong becomes a source of concern, and the state now intervenes. How does the state intervene? Well, it has basically the same instruments of war that the bandits have. It's not heavily armed. It's not armed with modern armaments. It is armies which move on their feet. But the Qing state is able to dispatch armies. But again, here we have more unintended consequences, because armies can't move quite as fast as bandits. So armies can wind up in the wrong place, the bandits move around, the bandits attack another town, the army is removed. In other words, you have, again, a different kind of dance. You have now the state trying to capture and repress the bandit armies. The bandit armies now have a different incentive. They're no longer worried about the village militias, they're worried about the army, and therefore they look to expand their numbers. And so they become more powerful, more numerous, not in order to have a rebellion against the state, but rather to protect themselves against the armies of the state. And so now you have an escalation with the state bringing more military, the armies, the bandit armies coming together, forming alliances, and forming bandit hideouts in the mountains and in the isolated parts of the countryside. You have now the state trying to figure out where are they, how can we trap them, how can we kill them. And so this escalation of violence continues. So her point is that rebellion is a local response to local conditions rather than an ideological attempt to attack the state. It's a very interesting theory, because what it basically says is these rebellions in North China, the ones that she studies, were not intended as rebellion at all. They were rather local violence, which began small scale and then just escalated as the parties kind of contested with each other, defended against each other, and eventually involved the state. That then escalated to full-scale battle between armies of, I think, 5,000 to 10,000 bandits against the armies of the Qing state. There are quite a few other examples that I find interesting of historians and political scientists who tried to use this local politics or rational actor theory in study of rebellion. We talked about Sam Hopkins' treatment of the Vietnamese rebellions two lectures ago. Elizabeth Perry gives particular attention to local politics, and none of these views give very much weight to either large-scale collective goals or to revolutionary ideology. I'm not going to discuss the Taiping Rebellion, the Taiping Rebellion, but a very similar story is told about the Taiping Rebellion, that there was religious content, but there was also then the development through the powerful gentry in South China developing more and more effective military militia organizations to defend against the Taiping. The state was basically incapable of defeating the Taiping, and instead, according to Philip Kuhn, the local society, local gentry, built more and more powerful, more and more effective militias, which eventually defeated the Taiping in a massive, massive, extended, multi-year conflict. So a militarized local society defeated the Taiping Rebellion. But another unintended consequence, by permitting or by having a situation where local society and the local gentry became so militarized, they in turn were more capable of resisting the state. So the state actually lost a lot of its capacity to control South China through the occurrence of the Taiping Rebellion, not just because of the destruction that occurred, but because of the creation of real military capacity in South China under the control of local gentry. That's an interesting other unintended consequence. Let's turn now to a class conflict. theory. We've just been talking about the class conflict theory, which says people rebel because they are subject of exploitation and domination, because they recognize that they are members of a class, because they recognize rationally that they have the power to overthrow these relationships. This is that very simple theory that I took issue with in the previous lecture. The simple theory says rebellions occur when the mass of producers acquire the political resources and good circumstances necessary for a potentially successful rebellion. The applications in 19th century China, which has been done by a number of historians, a number of kind of Marxist historians, they've looked at these big peasant movements as instances of class struggle. It's not an accident. Marxist historians are looking for evidence of class struggle, and peasant rebellions are an obvious place to look. But the French historian Joan Chesneau looks at the Taiping Rebellion as a class conflict struggle because part of the content of the Taiping Rebellion was a social program of agrarian reform. But it also was a movement with religious symbols, with charisma, with this kind of unusual adaptation of Christianity. So it had a lot of different aspects. The Marxist interpreters emphasized the class version of it. The story that I'd like to talk about a little bit here is by Robert Marx with a K, M-A-R-K-S, who is an American historian of China. His book, Rural Revolution in South China, is basically leading up to the Republican Revolution in 1900 to 1911, whatever. He's looking at rural collective action in South China, and he understands rural collective action as emerging from class conflict at the local level between peasants and landlords and between peasants and the state. So he basically says it was material class conflict of interest which led to peasant mobilization in South China. He argues that the class relations, the land relations in South China were highly exploitative, meaning wealth was created by peasants and transferred to landlords through the rent relation. So exploitation was highly visible. He thinks that peasants recognized and resented that exploitation, that it was highly salient, highly visible to them that they were being exploited, and that taxation and land tenancy were the major factors in stimulating protest and resistance. Well, that's pretty remarkable. We'll just start over there. One thing which I observe in reading Robert Marx's book is that he gives primary emphasis to a kind of, what you might call voluntarism, kind of idea that peasants just automatically come to their resentment and their class identity, and then they act. He doesn't give much attention, really much attention at all, to either leadership or to organization, but instead a kind of, he looks at a rebellion as a kind of visceral uprising of exploited people. He holds that indigenous peasant movements and political traditions were the primary factor, not the presence or absence of outside leadership and organization. There are some problems with this approach also, I think. This understanding of this particular series of historical events in South China, he does not provide an account of the mechanisms through which class identity emerges. And yet we saw an hour ago that class identity is not an automatic thing. There are lots of different ways in which the rural people of South China could think of themselves. And in fact, we know that some of those ways were very important. Lineage, for example, as I understand it, is much more important in South China than other parts of China. So lineage organization and family relationships, Marx doesn't pay any attention to those. He needs to give us a theory or an account of the mechanisms by which the class consciousness of peasants comes to be the most important identity. So I ask the question, what social mechanisms would permit a geographically dispersed class to arrive at a group identity based on its shared material interests? I refer here to the French historian Lucien Bianco, who is one of the really most important historians of rural China. And Bianco makes the point that there were lots of peasant uprisings throughout hundreds of years, maybe thousands of years of Chinese history, and they were almost always short and unsuccessful. His view is that many of these uprisings were stimulated by non-class factors, things like religion, inter-village conflict, vertical social organization. In other words, peasant mobilization, according to Bianco, occurred around many different kinds of factors, and those uprisings were almost always very short-lived. So he takes the view that if we want to explain the Chinese Revolution, it's actually in, he's building up to a theory of why the Chinese Revolution was successful, but it is Bianco's view that the determining factor was not social mobilization by peasants, that was an important factor, but the presence of an effective political organization and party, the Communist Party, was the most important factor. He thinks that it was the fact of the party and its political competence in kind of organizing its local people and organizing local activities in different parts of China, it is that organizational capacity that made the difference between a spontaneous peasant uprising and a successful revolution. Let's turn to the third example, which is the religious theory or the millenarian theory. And this is a consideration of, again, North China rebellions. These were also rural rebellions. They were referred to as the White Lotus Rebellions, which was a form of rural Buddhism and a heterodox form of religion, i.e., a form of religion not recognized or sanctioned by the state. So orthodox religion is sanctioned by the state. Heterodox religion is not sanctioned, in fact, is punished by the state. And White Lotus Buddhism was a heterodox, implicitly rebellious organization. It wasn't a violent organization, but it was an organization that was repressed by the state and which nonetheless continued to proliferate through North China. This is referred to as the Eight Trigrams Rebellion, and I have the mantra in a minute. Maybe you'll recognize the Chinese characters from the English. But I think the underlying theoretical idea is the question, how do religious movements, apparently irrational ideas, how do religious ideas and irrational ideas serve as a basis of mobilization and peasant unrest? What's the connection between religious organization and religious ideas and peasant unrest? And this author, Susan McCann, in her treatment of these two or three religiously inspired rebellions, what she identifies as the critical factor is the content of this sect of Buddhism. The content is called millenarian, meaning the millennium is coming, the end of the world is coming, and the way that you can tell that is by reading the signs of weather, let's say, or reading the signs of the decay of the state or decay of morality. And so the idea is that the sacred texts of this religion predict the end of the world very shortly, and also indicate what the signs are. Flooding, for example, maybe that's a sign. And so what she finds is that these rural religions, the White Lotus religion, was promulgated by traveling martial arts instructors who were practitioners of the movement and also martial arts instructors, and that they would travel from village to village. They would acquire followers whom they would train in the martial art, but they would also train in the esoterica of the religion, including things like chants and charms and religious beliefs and practices. And so these charismatic martial arts instructors, you could kind of follow their progress through a series of villages. In each village, they would acquire some followers, and they would communicate with them the content of the millenarian religion, that the end is coming, be ready for something terrible to happen. this is an interesting story. You know, as you kind of think about this series of villages, that is a micro-foundational story because it's kind of tracking the mechanism by which a series of instructors and martial arts instructors pass through rural society, transmit their ideas, create some mobilization, and then move on to the next area. Something that she finds very interesting is the content of the religion, not only the millenarian idea, but also the idea of invulnerability. The idea that by taking the chance, by eating the pieces of paper with the 8 trigrams, so you write the 8 trigrams on a piece of paper and then eat it, it is a charm. It makes you invulnerable. So you can be attacked with a sword and you won't be harmed. You can be shot with a gun and you won't be harmed. These apparently irrational beliefs of invulnerability and the power of the kind of magical power of the religion, she thinks that's a very important part of the content of the religion and the explanation of the rebellion. This is the mantra, eternal progenitor in our original home in the world of true emptiness. And this is expressed as 8 trigrams. And this was the mantra of the rebels in this movement. And so at the moment when the signs lined up, the sect leaders then called for popular uprising. The millennium is here. It's time to overthrow the Qing. It's time to rise up. And she says, and this call was heeded. Rural people, peasants throughout North China were mobilized, came together in large armies, and were eventually repressed by the state. She focuses, therefore, on the motivations and beliefs of the adherents, and she analyzes the organizational resources which were created by the sect, largely this little bit of hierarchy of leadership, but also then the activities of the practitioners as they travel through rural society. The quote is, I think it's actually a good quote, which you, of course, have in your notes. Vigorous leaders had used ordinary sect ties to build a sect organization of extraordinary size, and they had emphasized one dimension of the religion, apocalypse and millennium, to mobilize believers into rebellion. This is a very succinct statement of her theory. The organizational part, the transmission of ideas through these sect leaders and adepts or practitioners, and then secondly, the content and the call for action, which was associated through the content of the religion and also the activities of the leaders. Now, here are some criticisms of her view. It seemed to me in reading her book and then reading other books about the same period of time that she actually overemphasizes the religious content of these rebellions. It appears that only a minority of the followers and activists were members of the White Lotus sect. So that out of, let's say, 50,000 people, it seems that only 5,000 were actually members of the White Lotus sect. It continues to have the flavor of a millenarian movement, and yet 90% of the people who rose up apparently rose up for other reasons, having to do with hardship, lack of food, resentment of taxation. In other words, the sort of factors that we found in the local politics theory, those factors also seem to be important in these White Lotus rebellions. And so I would say that she's not paying enough attention to the material motivational factors which rebels had, and that her account needs to be added to, we need to add to her account ecological, material, and even class-based analysis from the other two theories. Nonetheless, my reading is, it's just a wonderful couple of books. She wrote 2 books on the subject, and they're really both tremendously interesting. So what's the upshot? We've now looked at 3 different kind of frameworks of analysis for the motivations which rebels in these different movements had. We looked at a rational choice / local politics theory, a Marxist or class conflict theory, and a millenarian or identity politics theory. And so we can ask the question, are these competing theories where one of them is true and the other two are false? Well, my view is that they're not. That each of these factors, material interest, ideology, local politics, organization, strategic interaction, these are all relevant to mobilization and uprising. They're relevant in different ways, and so the historian needs to be paying attention to all of those factors as she or he considers a particular case. None of these should be regarded as a comprehensive theory. Rather, they should each be interpretations of particular moments of rebellion. And furthermore, we do not have any reason to think that there is one most basic source of popular mobilization. It may well be that the White Lotus Rebellion was mostly stimulated by religious ideas. It could be that South China was mostly stimulated by class variables, and it could be the Mian Rebellion was mostly about this unintended dynamic between predation and protection. In other words, they're all possibly true and primary for different instances. So ideology, religion, class, moral economy, sense of justice, nationalism, all of these are factors which can be used by leaders for mobilization, which again says something about the plasticity of social process, because it says it is possible for a group leader to make use of any of these appeals and then build his case around that, you know, around the religious identity, around the class identity, around the lineage. And furthermore, I would say there are good examples of collective action that involve each of those. So it's kind of a nice way of wrapping up today's content to look at these specific periods of time in Chinese history when large collective action occurred and very different theories have been put forward, but I would assert those theories are compatible. And so as we look to the future or as we look to explain other forms of collective action, we need to be thinking of the multiple sources of mobilization and behavior that the participants may have. Well, cool. Well, we're 4/5 of the way through our total itinerary here. You're all aware, I hope, we have only one more class. Everybody aware of that? That's next Tuesday. And so we'll finish two more examples of Chinese history, and that's economic history, which again, I think will be pretty interesting to all of us. And then a final lecture on global justice and global civil society, which brings us back to my book, Paradox of Wealth and Poverty. I'm curious to hear from you, how much do